An Excellent Reason Not to Join the Military, by Amy Allison, alternate.org, Friday 05 May 2006. I was shocked to discover the realities of being a female minority in uniform. The following is an excerpt from the forthcoming book, 10 Excellent Reasons Not to Join the Military, to be published on May 18, 2006 by the New Press. Amy Allison served as a medic in the Army Reserves, and received an honorable discharge as a conscientious objector during the Persian Gulf War. I desperately wanted out of my small-minded hometown of Antioch, California, and the military recruiter on my high school campus promised me an escape hatch. The family that my white mother and African-American father created was based on the belief that the hard work and democratic values of 1960s activists made equality my birthright. But my day-to-day experience was full of evidence that racism was alive and well. High school classmates would chant the N-word when our team played its biggest rival the next town over. Slurs against gay people were so accepted that teachers used them without thought. And after winning a local junior Miss competition, a first for a black contestant, I was excluded from the local news and town parade. When I brought my Ivy League college acceptance letter into the career center, a counselor suggested that I got in because of my race. So I rushed to sign up for the Army Reserves, in part because it was the only place I knew of that promised I wouldn't be judged or limited by my race or gender. We women, people of color, and immigrants are especially attracted by the idea that we could live our lives on equal footing with other Americans. But the military isn't the egalitarian nirvana that its multi-billion dollar advertising blitz, with a budget of almost $4 billion in 2003, claims. Like most female soldiers, I learned the hard way that men dominate military culture. We are stuck in a system that makes it difficult to report abuse because of fear of reprisal. Even the military itself admitted in a June 2005 report by the Defense Task Force on Sexual Harassment and Violence at the Military Service Academies, harassment is the more prevalent and corrosive problem, creating an environment in which sexual assault is more likely to occur. Just ask any woman in uniform, sexual harassment is a common experience on base. I remember on the day of boot camp graduation, the same drill sergeant who had threatened to rip off my head and shit in my neck for a minor infraction during training, grabbed my arm in the on-base store, and pressured me for a date. This was a man that had exercised incredible power over me and my unit for 12 weeks, and through my fear I mumbled, "Drill sergeant, no," three times, before he let me go. I didn't know at the time that about 60% of women who have served in the National Guard and Reserve said they were sexually harassed or assaulted, but less than one quarter reported it. Many who did complain were encouraged to drop their complaints. When I first joined the military at age 17, a military doctor administered a demeaning and uncomfortable pelvic exam during my induction physical. He didn't wear gloves. It turns out that my experience wasn't unusual. At last year's National Summit of Women Veterans Issues in Washington, D.C., former Air Force officer Dorothy Mackey told of several instances of abuse during odd-gen exams. "He sodomized me," she said. "I started looking into what happens in a normal odd-gen examination, and that is definitely not supposed to be part of it." 9 out of 10 women under 50 who had served in the U.S. military and had responded to a survey reported being sexually harassed while in the service. In an episode of 60 Minutes, New Jersey National Guard Lieutenant Jennifer Dyer revealed that she was treated like a criminal after accusing a fellow officer of rape in early 2004. She reported the rape immediately to the Military Criminal Investigation Division, SID, who took her to a civilian hospital for a rape kit, then held her in seclusion for the next 3 days with no counseling and no medical treatment. The SID agent advised her of her Miranda rights and threatened to prosecute her for filing a false report. Her command announced her rape and accusation to the entire unit. By the time she returned to her unit after a 2-week leave, she was fearful for her health, safety, and sanity. Her assailant was roaming free on base, and was later acquitted of any crime. All the bad press about rape in the military has led to congressional demands for reform. For the 18th time in 16 years, the Pentagon has studied the problem and proposed changes, including designated victim advocates in every command and a promise of confidentiality, according to 60 Minutes. It's too bad that fully funding this need isn't a high priority. A Department of Veterans Affairs report released in September 2005 found that the annual cost for health care, including mental health for National Guard members like Lieutenant Jennifer Dyer who experienced sexual trauma, is about $20 million. Only $13 million is budgeted for the 2006 fiscal year. Reports of sexual assaults have skyrocketed recently, especially in hostile environments like Iraq and Afghanistan. The Washington Post reported, in many US military camps in Iraq, for example, signs are posted in female showers and other locations requiring US service women to be in the company of a battle buddy, especially at night, for their safety. The military has rules and structures to direct every aspect of a person's conduct. Why does abuse still occur? One answer is that a male commander most often decides when to prosecute for abuse or misconduct. In 2002, the number of female active army officers was about 20%. This means that the vast majority of officers in the military are men. In addition, military training itself is responsible for further desensitizing men to sexual violence. In January 2003, The Village Voice reported that military training has included efforts to get young soldiers used to the sounds of women being raped so that, if captured, hearing fellow soldiers assaulted would not cause them to crack. These revelations are not surprising to former Marine Corps Lance Corporal Stephen Funk. During his training in 2002, Stephen told me that his drill instructor gave a rousing speech at the end of Marine combat training. This is the reality of war. We Marines like war. We like killing. We like raping females. This is what we do. If there was a touch of irony in his voice, it sure wasn't clear to the young, impressionable group eager to prove they were men, Stephen said. Basic training also reinforces racism. Boot camp systematically breaks a recruit down physically and emotionally. Military discipline depends on eliminating individuality. Anything that makes you different from the standard, read straight white male makes you a target for abuse. But submissiveness and conformity are not the only goals of training. Soldiers are taught to follow orders in war without question. When the training taps into a person's own racist views, it's easier to convince them to kill people who are different. Iraq War veteran Aidan Delgado, who served as a mechanic in the 320th Military Police Company in Abu Ghraib, described how his training led to racism against Muslims and Arabs. Haji is the new slur, the new ethnic slur for Arabs and Muslims. It is used extensively in the military, he told a reporter. The Arabic word refers to one who has gone on a pilgrimage to Mecca, but it is used in the military with the same kind of connotation as gook, Charlie, or the N-word. Stephen, the former Marine corporal, said that his training on operating machine guns included a tip to avoid overheating the machinery, squeeze the trigger for as long as it takes to chant, "Die, fucking raghead, die," when riling up the troops. To take part in a nighttime simulation, the squad leader would yell, Stephen recalled, "Let's go burn some turbans." But racism in the military doesn't stop at Arabs. Basic training, a nightmare for most, is even more difficult if you happen to be a person of color or gay. If you are in these groups, I don't have to tell you that many times it's seemingly small insults that create a feeling of oppression. When I was at Army boot camp at Fort Jackson, South Carolina, standing in line for chow, I overheard the white drill sergeant tell a dark-skinned recruit with a smile, You look like Kunta Kinte Slave from the TV miniseries Roots. Doesn't she? Doesn't she? He asked everyone within earshot. She moved on silently in the wake of laughter. It was common for my drill sergeant to ask, "Where are my Chinese at?" when assigning laundry duty. For some reason, they do it the best, he'd say with a smirk. I went to training with many new immigrants, since recruiters often falsely promised them citizenship. One Sudanese immigrant was the butt of many of the drill sergeant's jokes. The sergeant would hand him a dark-colored rifle, and then loudly comment that they couldn't tell where the rifle ended and the hands began. In preparation for an ITOP simulation, the drill sergeant announced that recruits were to blow a whistle if they got lost. "Except you," he said, pointing at the Sudanese recruit. "You just smile, and we'll see you in the dark." Then the drill instructor made him stand up in front of the others. "Give me a pimp walk," the instructor ordered. English wasn't his native language and he hadn't been in the United States long, so he didn't understand what the sergeant meant. Then the sergeant pulled up another black recruit and said, "Give me a pimp walk." The man answered that he didn't know how, because he was into pimp. Finally, a white recruit volunteered to show the group. Pretty soon, many others were doing the black pimp walk as well. In the early morning hours during the second week of boot camp, I was forced to leave my barracks with an unfamiliar drill sergeant who decided to punish me for turning my head while standing at attention. I was afraid to go with a strange man to another part of the base, but was just as scared to refuse. He made me stand at attention and gathered his unit around to watch the show. He called me stupid, ugly, dumb. "Where are you from, private?" he screamed. "You look like a gang member. Are you a gang member?" I started crying. He looked at my dark skin and didn't know or care that I was an excellent student on my way to the university. "Get down into front position," he yelled at me in front of his own unit of women. "Get up. Get down. Get up." The 30 minutes of humiliation seemed to last an eternity. Although the military doesn't officially condone racism and sexism, it explicitly discriminates against gays who are open about their identity, both in legal practice and in day-to-day life. The Civissimo's Legal Defense Network, an advocacy group for gay and lesbian soldiers, claims that more than 65,000 lesbian and gay Americans are on active duty and serving in the National Guard and Reserves. Thanks to the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, put in place under the Clinton administration in 1993, as long as gay people stay deep in the closet, the military won't kick them out. In other words, Don't Ask, Don't Tell actually authorizes the federal government to fire someone for being gay. According to the Civissimo's Legal Defense Network, soldiers may be investigated and administratively discharged if they make a statement that they are lesbian, gay, or bisexual, engage in physical contact with someone of the same sex for the purposes of sexual gratification, or marry, or attempt to marry, someone of the same sex. Several soldiers have been discharged for posting online profiles that indicated they were gay or looking to date someone of the same gender. The other part of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy attempts to limit harassment and the scope of investigations into a soldier's sexual orientation. Yet, as Stephen Funk's experience shows, the services continue to violate these basic rules. Stephen, a gay man, told me what it's like to live with a constant barrage of anti-gay slurs. No one dares speak up against it, because they fear facing suspicion and investigation for being gay. Stephen's sergeant secretly investigated his homosexuality for more than a month by pulling other members of his unit into his office and grilling them about his suspicions. A soldier in his squad finally told Stephen about the interview the sergeant had asked him, "Did you notice anything funny? Did he touch you or use gay words? Do you agree that his feminine gestures and soft voice make him seem like a fag?" After learning about the investigation, Stephen was forever shaken, and self-conscious about his interactions with other soldiers. The military may try to sell itself as a level playing field, but as long as abuse is tolerated, and discrimination helps recruits pull the trigger, they will always be part of the soldier's experience. Amy Allison is a community activist and organizational consultant. She counsels military members seeking co-discharges, and is a leader in the counter-recruitment movement.